This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When we use the words founding fathers, it is generally with a sense of deep respect. In her new book, historian Joanne Freeman takes a closer look at honor and politics at the outset of our republic. Freeman says honor was all. It defined men and their politics. How might one defend one's honor or question the honor of another? Freeman says gossip, print warfare, and pistols were all tools the founders used to jostle for honor and political power. Joanne Freeman is the author of Affairs of Honor, National Politics in the New Republic. She is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. In her book, Freeman writes, "Too often the founders are praised to the skies as saintly deities of governance or condemned as self-interested elitists who cared for money and power above all else. In reality, they were something of both." Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. Questions and comments are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Joanne Freeman is Assistant Professor of History at Yale University. In addition to Affairs of Honor, she is the editor of Alexander Hamilton Writings. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Freeman, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Did the word honor mean something different to Americans of the 18th century than it does to us today?
Well, it did, actually, and particularly to the elite folk, the founders that I write about in my book, because attached to the idea of honor, which we all think about as sort of being noble and lofty and wonderful, was the code of honor, which was the way that you defended your personal honor as a gentleman. Now, clearly, if you were a gentleman in this time period and not a politician, your honor was hugely important, your reputation. It really was, in a sense, your identity was entirely wrapped up with your personal honor and how the world judged your reputation and honor. But if you were a politician, then your career also rests on that as well. I mean, elections are, in a sense, in this period, contests of reputation. So it's hugely important. And along with that importance, there's, in a sense, a rule book that offers different types of weapons and different kinds of strategies for defending your honor and reputation.
Now, how would someone size up the honor or reputation of another?
Well, it's a good question. It's not. It would have been wonderful for me as an author if I could have found a checklist, which I couldn't. But it's a combination of, I think, the way a person presents himself, but more important, the way everyone else appears to be respecting that person, which is kind of a roundabout answer. But in essence, if you appear to be a respected person in the community, others will treat you with that respect. If you do something to dishonor yourself and others treat you in a disrespectful manner and you witness someone being treated that way, then you, too, would begin to treat that person with less respect. So it's really sort of outwardly defined. It really just depends on how you appear in the world and how people are treating you.
Hmm. Now, when Congress is coming together in the early days of the Republic, they're coming from all over. What did they know of one another, and how did they go about trying to figure out who they would ally themselves with?
Well, it's really... It's something that it's easy for us to sort of overlook when you're thinking about this time period because, of course, to us, America is America, and granted, there are people who are obviously Southerners or people who are obviously New Englanders, but there's no question that they're all American. But in this time period, and particularly right when the Congress opened, a lot of people were not used to seeing people from other parts of the country. And for some people who had not served in the Continental Congress before, this was the first time they were seeing people from other parts of the country. And so part of what they're doing when they're meeting each other is essentially kind of scoping each other out and commenting in wonderful letters and in diary entries on, for instance, New Englanders thinking that the Southerners wear colors that are too bright, or they're too loud, or they bluster when they talk. All they talk about is horses and alcohol. And the Southerners, in reverse, sort of thinking that the New Englanders seem really stiff and that they're wearing drab colors and that they don't seem to ride around in carriages very much. And so part of what you have is really people kind of trying to figure out what American is. And coming up against things that they are not necessarily used to coming up against. So it's not an easy thing to decide, even just for that reason, who it is you're going to link yourself up with or who it is you're going to oppose. So that's part of what they're doing, is sort of trying to get past, I guess, appearance and manner to try and figure out, well, what is this guy? But also, because everything was so political at this time period, the government's just starting, and people are very worried about it being very fragile and very vulnerable and very weak. And it's Republican, which means a small r Republican. You know, it's grounded on the people. It's not supposed to be monarchical. So, but there's no real definition of what that means because Americans have just sort of invented it. And so they're watching each other, too, to try and see if you can tell someone's politics by how they're dressing or how they're acting. So that if someone's clothes are too fancy, well, maybe that's a monarchical kind of a person. Maybe I don't want to link up with that kind of a person because he seems to be a little dangerously, you know, aristocratic looking, and vice versa. So people are also, in a really self-conscious way, which I love. I mean, you don't expect John Adams to be talking about lace on jackets, you know, in his letters, but he is, you know, and they're talking about letters. Actually, Adams has a second letter in which he's very defensive because someone accuses him of riding in a carriage with six horses, which is supposedly monarchical. And George Washington actually defends him and says, no, 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 it's four horses. It's much more Republican than that. It's not six, but four. And Adams is very defensive and says, I walk in the streets a lot. I'm very Republican. You can't challenge me. I'm not always in my carriage. Which seems like a kind of a ridiculous conversation, but they really were afraid of sort of warping things into being what they had been before, which in their mind was sort of aristocratic and, you know, monarchical.
Yeah. They're trying to move forward. They're trying to do the right thing. At the same time, they're looking back to the example of Britain.
Right. 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 They can't help it. I mean, that's where they come from. And so, I mean, it's really, again, it's almost comical when you look at Congress, the debates in Congress in the very beginning, particularly when they're trying to figure out really basic things like how do we address each other in the House, or, you know, what kind of ceremony should we have, or what's the proper title for the president? And some of them will be coming forward with ideas that seem, as you put it, sort of forward-looking and new. But other people very naturally say, well, what do they do in Parliament? They're kind of like us over there. What do they do there? Does anyone know? And there's usually someone in the room who can say, well, I was in Parliament once. Here's what I think they do. So they can't help it.
Yeah. And so altogether, put all this together, how you describe it is, you know, barely controlled chaos.
Definitely high anxiety as far as politics goes. And in their minds, certainly, it would be always on the edge of collapsing into chaos.
There's not yet a true party system, so this means that people can stand under more than one political umbrella, so to speak.
Right, right. I mean, and that adds to the problem because, you know, if you think about it, nowadays people, you know, come in with clear party affiliations, and that means you kind of know without even knowing the person what you expect that person to do and how you expect them to vote, and there's the occasional surprise, but still people are predictable. But when you don't have that in this early period, well, then how do you know how the person you're looking at is going to act or vote? You have no idea. So, yeah, first of all, without a party system, I think in the book I describe it as a war without uniforms. You can't really tell who your friends and enemies are in that kind of a climate.
You say that in the early going, honor, democracy, and republicanism joined to form a distinctive political culture, I'm quoting you here, governed by a grammar of political combat. It was a body of assumptions too familiar to record and thus almost invisible to modern eyes. Almost invisible. So how do you go about, as a historian, trying to find the rules of this grammar?
Well, it's funny. It sort of hinted at itself at the very beginning of this project. I kept coming across letters in which politicians would say, like James Monroe would say, Adams attacked me in a speech. I don't know how to respond. Here are my options. And he would literally set out, you know, I could write a pamphlet or I can go to the newspapers. And Monroe actually does say, I could challenge him to a duel, but I can't because he's an old man and the president, which is sharp and wonderful logic. But in the letter, he's picking off a list of weapons. And that suddenly made me think, wow, there's a rule book here that we haven't noticed before. James Monroe thinks there are five different ways he can respond to a certain kind of insult. I want to try and figure out what those rules are, which is easy to say, but then to actually figure it out was another challenge. And I did have about a month of panicked research at the Library of Congress in which I couldn't figure out how to find what I wanted, although I kind of knew it had to be there, until I finally realized, I think I even do call it this in the book, the ouch factor, which is I wasn't always seeing the weapon being deployed, but I was always seeing the ouch in response. And so I would look in letters essentially for emotion, for their response, for their outrage at being attacked or for their joy at someone else being attacked. And if you follow the trail of emotion, you start to get a sense of what they think should or shouldn't be happening.
Hmm. With a number of possibilities out there for these men in terms of responding to an attack, let's say, upon their honor, how did they go about choosing which route to take?
Well, it was kind of a combination of things. On the one hand, the rules sort of gave you some guidance. So, for example, if I were to insult you, but I was someone who was far beneath you in status, the sort of unwritten rule book would say, well, you can't challenge me to a duel because I'm beneath you. But you could cane me. You could attack me with a cane and beat me publicly to sort of shame me. That would be the proper response. So there is some guidance from the rule book, but still, no situation is ever that clear cut, or few are. So you have a lot of letters, like the first one I mentioned with James Monroe, in which people are writing to their friends and saying, I don't know what to do. Give me advice. And those also were the kinds of letters that were hugely useful for me in trying to decode what they were doing in this time period.
Mm. And writers in newspapers, they were among the folks that you wouldn't challenge to a duel because they were
right.
They were so low.
Right. Journalists were too low to duel. This is true. And so it was, you know, among the risks, financial risks even, you know, being a printer in this time period is no easy thing, and newspapers are going out of business all the time. But above and beyond that, you ran the risk of getting caned on a regular basis. Because if you insulted a politician and he felt personally wounded in some way, he very often would turn around and find you on the street and beat you. So it was a risky business, a political printer.
We got it much better today.
Yes. At least they can rule out caning for the most part.
Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, this is a time of high anxiety. The stakes were high for the nation and for the reputations of its leaders. And William McClay gives us a really fine sense of the anxiety of the day. Who was he, and what were his observations about the political anxieties of that time?
Well, William McClay is quite wonderful. He's a senator. He's from Pennsylvania. He's sort of from out in western Pennsylvania, so he's not sort of an urban kind of a fellow. And he's new to the national political stage, so he really feels like a newcomer. And he's the kind of a person, he has this very dour sense of humor, and he's really observant and really insecure, which are two really good things for a historian to find, because he writes everything down, including all of his fears and anxieties. And he left behind this amazing, amazing diary. Actually, it's three huge volumes of a diary in which he wrote down everything. He wrote down his dreams. He wrote down things he heard people whisper while he was sitting in his seat at the Senate. You know, he wrote down, he heard someone say to someone else, John Adams needs his wig dressed. You know, this goes in the diary. So it's a wonderful, wonderful way to really get a sort of eyewitness account of what it feels like to arrive on the national scene and sort of take your place in the government. And he really does give a sense of not knowing who anyone is or how to figure out who they are, or should you trust them, or shouldn't you trust them? What's the proper way to behave? There's an amazing story in his diary in which he's at a dinner party, and George Washington is there, and McClay is always flustered around George Washington because George Washington is the greatest man in the world to him. And he walks in the room, and he sees Washington, and he sort of awkwardly bows towards him, and then he starts across the room towards an empty seat next to a bunch of New Englanders, as he puts it in his diary. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees Washington gesture to a seat and say, you know, here, sit here. But he's already started walking past Washington, and he actually stops dead in the middle of the floor and thinks to himself for a minute, what's the right thing to do? You know, what's the Republican thing to do? I don't want to treat Washington like a king. If I turn around and I treat him with too much respect, am I treating him like a king, and is that bad for the government? And he actually does not take the seat and continues across the room because he's afraid of doing something that might hurt the government in its infancy, which is really shows you how self-conscious they are at this time about what they're doing.
Yeah, and also he was very uncomfortable going to the affairs that were called levees.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he was not a fellow who was necessarily really comfortable at all the social events that he goes to. So, yeah, Washington would have these levees Tuesday afternoons, and all of the national office holders and the diplomatic folk would come and gather in this room and form a circle, and Washington would sort of go from person to person and murmur something happy and chatty with each of them and go on to the next person. And McClay, first of all, as I said, he's just in a panic around Washington because he just thinks Washington is too wonderful for words. But also, he just isn't really good at that sort of a formal social occasion. So he really doesn't like it. He thinks it's his duty as a senator. He has to go, but he's always really happy when his fellow senator goes instead of him and sort of takes the responsibility of Pennsylvania over and relieves him from having to go.
Yale historian Joanne Freeman is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about her book, Affairs of Honor, National Politics in the New Republic. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us with questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Champaign on line one waiting to talk with us. Good afternoon.
Hi, this is a really great topic. I think especially during times of national crisis, people look to the Founding Fathers, and what I find interesting is they're a really complex lot as far as, you know, there's so many people involved and so many really intriguing personalities and people who do and don't get along with each other. And it's hard for me to imagine them all being locked. I think it was Liberty Hall in Pennsylvania. They're in some second-story room when they're trying to actually write the Constitution. And it's just amazing because I don't know if it's because they were concerned of their reputation or they really felt, yes, we are founding the new republic. This is a really cool thing that we don't want to see go down. But they were really very genteel, and there was a real effort, I think, to compromise at times when they felt like killing each other.
Right.
Is that true, or is that just a historical thing that historians look at and go, this is really interesting, or are they that concerned about their reputations, or is it the Republic?
Well, sometimes, absolutely, that comes to the fore, that the sense that they're doing something huge, and I think especially, as you're noting, when they're drafting the Constitution, they know that they're trying to create a country which in itself is pretty huge. They also know that they're trying a new kind of a country, you know, that's grounded on the people in a new kind of a way. And they really feel, and they say, you know, we're going to determine for humankind if it's possible to form a government based on reflection and discussion in a room here, like we're doing here, or whether governments are always going to be the result of war or circumstance. So they have this huge sense of responsibility, particularly there when they're drafting the Constitution, but it's always sort of there beneath the surface. And even though at moments it seems pretty far from the surface, when other things sort of take over, and, you know, as you're saying, you know, there are some pretty interesting personality quirks among these guys, sometimes it's not the most apparent thing, but you do find at moments of absolute ultimate crisis, they do sort of down in some part of their heart think that no matter how bad they assume their enemies are, they're not so bad that they're actually going to do something deliberately harmful to the Republic. That when push comes to shove, everyone would, of course, defend the Republic in some way. So it is always there beneath the surface. It's just better occasions is when they allow it to sort of get up near the surface as opposed to sort of shoving it beneath the surface in the middle of conflict.
Well, and what I find interesting, and I was curious because it sounds like you've really read through, wow, you know, source material, is Washington really struggling to be the good man? Because that's the one thing I keep finding, that like Eisenhower in some ways during World War II, he is trying to make peace, and he's trying to get people to, you know, get together, and it seems, I wonder if he was chosen as president for that skill, that he really, I don't know if it's European noblesse oblige or if he's just, you know, consummated with this personal moral struggle. But most people, I think when you talk about him making small talk in a room, I often wonder if people are asking his advice on safe farming or deportment. You know, how should I, you know, conduct my business affairs and stuff? I'm just curious, is he the man's man, or I hate to use such a sexist term, but is a sexist time, is that true, or?
Well, he definitely, you know, it's as a historian, you never want to sort of step out and say, this one man made the difference, you know, but mm-hmm. in this case, you can say that, because he's pretty much the only person that they trusted the presidency with when the government starts. And the reason that is, not only is he already kind of the only, you know, he's an American legend because he led, you know, America through the Revolution and we won against, you know, this enormous empire of Britain. But the most, in a sense, the greatest thing Washington ever did was, after the war, resign his position as commander-in-chief and go back home to his farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned his back on power. And that was hugely important. I mean, the world responded to that. Because here was someone who had a whole country under his control, and he surrendered it and went home. And as soon as he did that, he became the one person who America would always trust with power. So he was the guy on the spot. So certainly in that way, he was someone who definitely was going to be treated as a sort of trustworthy figure who people would follow for guidance. And people did. You know, as a matter of fact, McClay, when he has small talk with McClay at One Levee, it's farm talk. They're sort of talking about plows and the weather or something, you know, some kind of thing like that. But Washington also was really, really super, sort of hyper self-consciously worried about what a president is supposed to be. You know, it's a new invention, president of the United States. And he wants to act dignified and authoritative enough so that Americans will respect the position, but not so dignified and authoritative that he'll seem like a king.
What I find interesting, and thank you for answering my questions, I could ask a bazillion of them, especially about, like, Dolly Madison, but there's a character, I can't remember, I believe his name is Wilson, and he's from one of the southern states, and he is viewed as being a politician who is really out there just kind of marketing himself, chumming up to the common folk, oh goodness forbid, and, you know, really selling himself to the masses. And what's interesting is this is a front, offends a lot of the founding fathers, which I think is interesting, because then we have Madison, who is perhaps the most complex. But Wilson, interestingly enough, put in a lot of the guarantees that we view as being really crucial to the Constitution. And I'm curious how he contrasts with Madison, because in this one thing I read, I guess Madison was mainly against the importation of slaves because they had a surplus of slaves in Virginia. And I'll just get off the phone, and I'm just curious, because the Southern politicians, we now don't see how crucial the South is to the foundation of the Republic, I think, that Virginia is the, you know, keystone state, whatever Pennsylvania may claim, you know. So thank you very much.
Sure.
Did you want to go ahead and respond to the final thoughts
that
the caller had?
Two parts of it.
Yeah.
The first is really interesting, the idea of politician and of someone sort of marketing himself. That was, particularly in the early period, really frowned upon, because you're never supposed to be seeking popularity as a politician. You know, they're not even really calling themselves politicians at this point. But you're supposed to be doing what you consider to be what's in the public good. And sometimes that might be unpopular, and you're supposed to be willing to risk your, you know, your career or your reputation to do what you feel is the right thing. It would have been really controversial for someone to be marketing themselves. And there are very few people in this period among the elite who would dare do anything that aggressive. But as far as the South goes and the slavery issue goes, that, of course, is an enormous issue. And, in fact, so enormous that the Constitutional Convention ends up not being really able to do anything other than push it aside and not deal with it, because there does not appear to be a way to deal with it that will keep the South in the Union. And unfortunately, that's the story for a long stretch of time, is that it keeps coming up, of course, and it keeps getting pushed aside because it always seems like the deal breaker. You know, there's no way to deal with this. The Union's fragile. We got to worry about the Union, so we'll just shove this slavery issue off to the side. And, of course, eventually this becomes an explosive issue.
Hmm. Back to the idea of the no-no of marketing yourself in a campaign. While you didn't market yourself, you weren't so brazen to do that, you did campaign. And maybe you would talk with us about how campaigns were conducted in the early days of the Republic.
Sure. You did campaign and you didn't.
Right.
You didn't really do very much on your own behalf. Your friends were very important during an electoral campaign because they could electioneer on your behalf, but there's very little you could do to promote yourself because, of course, as soon as you seem to be promoting yourself, you seem ambitious, and you're thus the person who should not be trusted with power. So the people who are most going to be wanted for office are the people who appear to be least interested in it. And that's how, for example, in the presidential election of 1796, you have the candidates essentially at home, sort of reading the newspapers and trying really hard not to involve themselves, not to comment on anything, to sort of stand back, and their friends can run around and sort of promote their interests, but they're trying desperately not to look as though they're interested. So that they will seem as though they're trustworthy and that they deserve to have the office.
So you might have, so to speak, an agent out there in your behalf, on your behalf, writing letters or conducting what were called interviews with...
Precisely. You would have, and very often they would, their phrase for this would be particular friend. They would say the particular friends of Mr. Jefferson or the particular friends of Mr. Hamilton. And these particular friends would be... having sort of dinners and conversations and trying to court people and sometimes writing for the newspapers, definitely writing endless letters and acting, as you say, sort of as agents.
Hmm. And there were campaigns not only, to use that term kind of loosely, there were campaigns not only for the popular vote, but also for the votes of the electors.
Right, right. I mean, the Electoral College, I think, is still confusing to us today. But at the time, what it meant, essentially, is every state could appoint its electors any way it wanted. And then these electors, of course, would vote for president. And in almost every state, the legislature picked electors. So think about how far removed that is from the people. You know, the people elect the legislature chooses electors, and the electors vote for president. And because of that, the electors became crucial. And there weren't that many of them. I think in 1796, there were, 135 electors. And so you actually have people saying, for example, in 1796, during that election, to their friends, hey, you know, you take 60 and I'll take 60 and maybe we can get them all. And if we can talk to each of them, maybe they'll vote for our guy. And that was entirely conceivable, that they could do that before an election and talk with every single elector who would be voting and hopefully win them over to their side.
Hmm. Let's go back to some issues of honor. Gossip, you write, was everywhere. Tell us about the whisperings that went on and their impact.
Well, that was actually one of the first things I wrote in the book was about political gossip,
mm-hmm.
Because I began noticing people saying things about other people and seemingly being either outraged definitely they had a sense that there were certain things you should say and certain things you shouldn't and ways in which you should or shouldn't say them. What I discovered was, of course, if character and reputation are so important, what better way to fight a political battle than to attack the character and reputation of your opponent? And a fine way of doing that was in deploying political gossip. And they had words. Their word was collect. He would collect gossip, and then he would drop pieces of gossip in strategic locations, hopefully to get at the reputation or sort of deteriorate, you know, decay, destroy what others thought of your opponent.
Really, really honorable thing to do, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, they were doing it in what they thought was an honorable way.
Sure.
You know, you're getting up against some pretty thin lines that they're walking here. But they wouldn't ever say anything unless they checked their sources, for example. They wanted to know that it was true before they said it, even though it's very easy for us to look at it and say, oh, for crying out loud, there's no way that could have been true. In their mind, they were trying only to spread what appeared to them to be the truth. So a lot of what you look at in this period, you have to really sort of climb into their head to sort of get at any way in which what they are doing could seem honorable in any way.
Yeah. Now, does it bear any resemblance to what today we call mudslinging?
Yeah. I mean, certainly you could call it mudslinging. I think, in a sense, back then, you're thinking a lot more about the mud that you're slinging. Because, of course, if you make a wrong step, say the wrong thing in the wrong way or to the wrong person or too publicly, then you are walking on dangerous ground, because then if you are personally attacking someone in a way that he feels affects his private character, and if he feels that public, you know, this has been done in a public way, then you're moving back into dual territory. And indeed, it's sometimes that it is political gossip deployed in a clumsy kind of a way that leads sometimes to duels.
What does lead to a duel? What leads to that challenge being thrown out?
Well, the ultimate thing, and I suppose the rule book would say, that you fight a duel when your personal character has been attacked. So you can say, I think President Washington is doing the wrong thing here. That's acceptable. But if you say, I think President Washington is lying to us about it, that's not. That's attacking his personal character. And under those circumstances, a gentleman is allowed to defend his name by issuing a challenge, and that's sometimes what happens. But very often what you find in this time period, and it was one of the more surprising things I found, again, towards the beginning of the project, is that duels, in our mind, are sort of, you know, you have a slip of the tongue, you do something wrong, and there's a duel. Very often, they were really deliberately provoking them. And they would either do this when times were bad, like when the debate was going against them in Congress and they wanted to sort of pull things back to their control, they might drop some kind of a comment on the floor so that the debate would now become focused on them and would sort of shift away from wherever they didn't want it to go. And even more than that, if you lost an election, very often, and of course your reputation then has been damaged, the winner or one of his friends would actually deliberately provoke a duel with or his friends would deliberately provoke a duel with the winner or one of his friends to sort of redeem himself from the loss of the contest.
Hmm. Yeah, because once an election was over, you were not likely to, although this did happen, you were not likely to go up to your opponent and shake his hand and say, well, now I join with you in the best interests of the nation.
Right, because it was deeply humiliating. Again, if what you really are relying upon for your sense of self is what others think of you, and then you've just put yourself out in the open and said, here, vote for how you think of me, and the vote is, we don't think much of you. We think much more of your opponent. Definitely, you're going to have a very strong personal reaction to that. You're going to feel somewhat mortified and humiliated, and in some cases, you're going to feel compelled to do something to redeem your name, or you're afraid that your followers won't follow you anymore because you won't seem like a leader who might be winning.
And that's what happened in the Jefferson Adams situation, right? After Adams' victory, Jefferson, I don't know, was it he wrote him a letter of friendship or something, and this was not in the tenor of the times. It was difficult to understand what was going on between these two men.
Right. Right. Well, it's interesting because, right, there was a weird moment when Adams wins the presidency, and Jefferson, who's opposed to him politically, wins the vice presidency. And Jefferson is trying to figure out the proper way to behave in this situation, and his first impulse is to write a letter in which he expresses his how much he thinks of Adams and what a fine patriot he is and how happy he would be to serve under him as vice president. But Jefferson is a really savvy politician, and he actually doesn't just send that letter. He sends it first to his friend James Madison and says, as he does very often, what do you think? Should I give this or not? And Madison actually says, no, don't put it in writing. We can let Adams know this, and actually through gossip. I know people who, if we say this to them, they'll go straight to Adams and tell him that. So he'll get the message from you, Jefferson, but don't put it in writing because it'll be able to be used against you in the future, which is a very politically savvy thing to say. And that's indeed what happens, is they leak this, you know, to someone who they know is going to go straight to Adams, which he does. And says, Mr. Jefferson thinks a lot of you, and the message is sent.
Trial balloons aloft from the very early days of the Republic.
Right.
Let's go back to the subject of duels, because I think it's very interesting. And you open the book right off the top with a story of Alexander Hamilton on a very frustrating July day in 1795. He issued on one day two challenges to duel.
Right.
What? Whatever was going on.
A very, very bad day for Hamilton. That's a wonderful story because it's usually told as two stories. When historians in the past talk about it, they'll talk on the one hand of the bad day, and then they'll talk on the other hand about the challenges, but they've never put them together. And what actually happens is there's a huge political rally in New York. Hamilton stands up to try and sway the crowd towards his point of view, and the crowd boos and hisses him, and someone actually throws a rock, which hits him in the head, and he retreats along with his friends, mortified. And so he's been publicly humiliated, publicly dishonored and disgraced, and you know, the crowd has told him what they think. So there he is in this mood, feeling dishonored, disrespected, and as he's walking down the sidewalk, along the way, he's encountering, you know, gentlemen of various political stripes engaged in conversation, and his reputation is sort of hurting, and he's feeling the need somehow to redeem himself. And so, not surprisingly, when he first engages in a conversation with some people he finds talking, the first time when one of the people turns around and says essentially to him, "Oh, shut up! You're not part of the conversation anyway, and why should I listen to you?" Hamilton loses control, and instantly there's a challenge. Because he feels like here's a person disrespecting me because he thinks he can, because he sees, you know, I've been just disrespected, and here he is trying to take advantage of that. So, no, you're not going to get the better of me. I challenge you to a duel. And he storms off, having thrown off one challenge, and now, of course, is in a real rage, and you can just sort of see him stalking down the sidewalk and then encounters another conversation, and at this point entirely loses his temper and apparently, according to witnesses, began waving his fists in the air and saying that he'd fight the whole detestable faction of his enemies one at a time. And, of course, someone steps forward and says, "Well, I'll take you up on that." And so suddenly there's another duel challenge in which he actually has to say to this fellow, "Well, you'll get a challenge soon. I've got another one pending. But as soon as that's out of the way, I'll be back to you."
But ultimately things are smoothed over.
They are. They are. And the vast majority of challenges do not result in duels because, of course, the most important part of the whole ritual of a duel is being willing to die to defend your name and your honor. And if you issue or accept a challenge, you're willing. You know, you've shown that you're ready to die. And very often it's possible through intricate negotiations to sort of negotiate your way out of something after you've had that initial moment where you've both stepped forward and said, "Yeah, I'll die too." You don't ever really have to even get to the dueling ground. In this case, actually, the first fight that Hamilton became engaged in almost did result in a duel, and it was not till the night before they would have been leaving for the dueling ground that there's a successful apology drafted in which Hamilton's enemy is willing to sign and which appeases Hamilton enough so that they actually settle matters. But Hamilton had already drawn up a will and was ready to go for a duel the next day. It was absolute last minute.
Well, it's another July day 9 years later, 1804. Things don't get smoothed over between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. Why, in that instance, weren't things smoothed over?
The Burr-Hamilton duel is a sort of combination of bad responses, clumsy responses, and long-standing ill will, you know, because, as Burr says in the course of their talking when they're negotiating this duel, Hamilton had been opposing his career for 15 years, pretty much as soon as the national government starts, their opponents. And in 1804, Hamilton had once again stepped forward and in this case lost the gubernatorial election in New York City for Burr. So he's been dishonored in an election, and his followers are really saying to him, I don't know if, you know, it makes sense for us to sort of stick around because you don't appear to be someone with much promise. So he really feels the need to defend his name and his career. And so when he is handed a piece of information that in his mind justifies him calling on Mr. Hamilton and asking about this insult, he does. Hamilton, unfortunately, responds. You can tell he's conflicted in the response, and it's an unfortunate conflict. He starts out by sort of trying to tap dance his way out of this by sort of talking about the precise words, you know, that supposedly Hamilton had said something despicable about Burr. So Hamilton starts talking about, well, what does despicable mean anyway? Is it such a bad word? I don't know, between gentlemen. Despicable maybe isn't such a bad word. That's insulting all by itself. And then because he doesn't want to be seen cowardly, he concludes the letter with a little sort of swagger in which he says, you know, of course, I'm ready to fight when you are. It's a bad, bad letter. It's a letter in which he's at the same time trying not to fight and trying not to dishonor or shame himself. And Burr responds, as one would predict, he's you know, enraged. And then, unfortunately, he writes a letter back to Hamilton, insulting him and essentially saying Hamilton is not behaving like a gentleman, which is a mortifying thing for him to say. And, of course, Hamilton's response to that is, how dare you? And that there they are now, entrenched, neither one feeling capable of pulling back because just in the process of negotiating the duel, they've each essentially given each other a slap. And from this point, it just sort of, you know, spirals down into the actual duel itself.
Yeah. Aaron Burr often is seen as, you know, as a villain. And you point out in the book, honor-bound politicians are not always honorable. I'm wondering, you know, if you'd share your opinion of this controversial figure in our history, Aaron Burr.
Well, it's funny. Burr, every chapter in the book focuses on a person, and Burr gets the last chapter. And I'm a person who, in the past at least, has pretty much done a lot of work on Alexander Hamilton and not very much on Aaron Burr. And to my great surprise, as I began writing about Aaron Burr and the presidential election of 1800, I began to understand some parts of why he behaved as he did, and he began to seem somewhat less of a sort of villainous character. And so to my enormous surprise, I ended up not quite vindicating him, but at least justifying some of his actions, which is not what I expected to do when I started writing about him. But in fact, he is really trying to abide by his sense of gentlemanly honor. The problem with Burr is almost everyone else around him is also abiding by this sense of sort of political honor. You know, this republicanism, what they think America should be, and this idea that they need to do the right thing to serve the public good, and if they do, then they'll be founders. You know, they actually all know that they can achieve this everlasting fame if they just do the right thing in the public good. And Burr just seems detached from that whole strain of thought. You know, Hamilton is just as ambitious as Burr, but Hamilton doesn't want to behave badly because he really wants to be, you know, someone who's famous for having done great things for his country, and so he feels reined in. And that's why he really understands Burr, who just kind of isn't interested in the whole issue. So he's behaving honorably, but he's not bound in. He seems like a political opportunist. And so he seems really dangerous, and he's not quite understandable to a lot of other people in his time. Add to that the fact that he's a really cunning politician, and you have a person who people love to have on their side, but nobody trusts him personally. So you want him campaigning for you, and he's one of the few people who actually does sort of get down and dirty and have a staff of lieutenants who he sends off campaigning in the different wards in New York. So it's great to have him, and he wins battles for you, but then you don't really trust the guy afterwards.
Hmm. Very interesting. Professor Freeman, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Joanne Freeman is the author of Affairs of Honor, National Politics in the New Republic. She is also editor of Alexander Hamilton Writings. She is a professor of history at Yale University. The book, Affairs of Honor, is published by Yale University Press.